Hi, everyone, and Happy New Year. To start 2026 off, Moira and I had a big plan, a three-part series on the Wright's love of education and educational grifting, ranging from Peter Thiel's Antichrist lectures to, you know, various YouTube universities with heavy, heavy quotation marks to the actual scam universities that right-wingers from Donald Trump to Barry Weiss are so fond of. Well, we did record 2.5 hours of material for this series, and we just felt it wasn't quite up to snuff yet. We're going to re-record. We're going to do this series for sure. But for now, what we decided to do was to give you a little bit of a teaser of an episode that went up on our Patreon just last week. It's an in-depth discussion of Olivia Nuzzi's American Canto, which has been burning up the worst of year lists across 2025. Michael was kind enough to stop by and talk to us about this book. We all three read it, and now we're inflicting it on you. So this is going to be the first 15 minutes of our Patreon conversation. If you want to hear the rest of it, please subscribe to our Patreon. It really helps us do this kind of show. And while we're obviously a little bit embarrassed to have recorded 2.5 hours and then listened to it and be like, yeah, we can't inflict this on people, your support through Patreon does make that possible, that we can just sort of say, look, this isn't good enough. We edited it. We listened to it. We didn't think it was quite up to snuff. We're going to go back to the drawing board and do a new version of this episode, talk to some experts, maybe get some guests and figure out how to tell this story right. That takes time. And honestly, it takes some money as well. So yeah, it kind of feels right to inaugurate 2026 with a plea for our Patreon and for your support. If you can't do it, if you can't make it, don't worry about it. We totally get it. But you do really make it possible for us to do this show at the level at which we're doing it by supporting us on Patreon. And you get to hear us snark about L'Affaire Olivia, as Moira calls it in the episode, all the way through.
It's going to be so hard not to just read fucking excerpts of this book constantly and be like, damn.
So here it goes. Here's something new for Embedded with the Right, a poetry reading. The politician communicates an acid message through an intermediary. There are lemon trees in the yard. I did not plant them. There is a fist in my chest. It is not mine. I imagine a lemon slides through, bled dry. The fist squeezes the fruit, but there is nothing left, and the fruit heaves pits, and the pits lodge in my throat. Quod me nutrit, me destruit. What nourishes me, destroys me.
A, like, constant of this book is these like tortured extended metaphors. Dude, that I sit there trying to figure out just logistically. I'm like, wait, you're eating a lemon?
It's not clear to me she knows how metaphors work. She has the whole thing of like, I was born on January 6th, the same day as the riots or whatever. And you're like, okay, that's a weird coincidence, but I don't think it means anything.
First page is like, when you think about it, I am just like JonBenet Ramsey.
That JonBenet Ramsey stuff. Why? And the weird 9/11 stuff, the Britney Spears stuff, the fucking manta ray.
And I'm like, no.
It's so good.
Dude, I looked in this 300-page book. The word sun appears 68 times because of how many times she's like standing on a cliff and staring at the sunset. And you're like, I don't need this. I don't need a description of the sunset again.
Yeah, did you know how California has like weird sunlight?
Wow, it's nice. She has like the New York versus LA thing too. She's like, people in LA are like this and people in New York, I'm like, yeah. No one cares. Even people in LA and New York don't fucking care about this. This is not interesting to listen to at all. I'm sorry.
First off, hello, I'm Adrian Daub.
And I'm Moira Donegan.
And whether you like it or not, you're in the middle of the taping of Embedded with the Right with the one and only Michael Hobbs.
If Olivia can do this to us, we're going to do it to you. Now you have to hear it.
You may have figured out by now that today we are discussing L'Affaire d'Olivia and Miss Nuzzi's autobiography, American Canto, which we actually read for you. Oh, yeah. People.
The things we do for $4 a month.
Hours of my life that I will never get back.
Unbelievable.
I mean, given that we already talked about how Olivia Nuzzi doesn't seem to know how metaphor works, I'm going to preview my big takeaway from this book. It like hit me this morning at 4 a.m. I'm jet lagged as shit. And it is Olivia Nuzzi is Thomas Chatterton Williams.
She's like somehow worse. I did not think that you could hit the ground and keep digging, but here we are. I think... like, I mean, I read bad nonfiction books for a living. I think this is the worst nonfiction book I've ever read. Not even like for the show, but this was absolute torture to get through. And also a book that is 300 pages long and says nothing. It says nothing about the story at the heart of it, about her and RFK.
Very little.
Says nothing about American politics.
Yeah.
It says nothing about like her as a person. There's no like basic biographical information in this book. It has like, speaking of horrible metaphors, in the New York Times, I mentioned like she wrote a lot of it on the Notes app while she was hiking. And you really get the sense she's like,
yeah, you can kind of tell.
She's like, I came across a rattlesnake on the trail, and it made me think of how truth and lies are wrapped up with each other like a rattlesnake. And you're like, this doesn't do anything. This isn't smart. You're just like coming across random things and then trying to make it a metaphor. But it's like you have to actually say something for this to be useful.
So this book is Olivia Nuzzi's autobiographical account, really, of her time as a journalist over the past 10 years of the Trump era, and then sort of most notably of her affair with a man she calls the politician. So
who could guess? Who could even guess who it is? Who can,
RFK Jr., mm-hmm. the current Health and Human Services secretary who is destroying America's health infrastructure.
The only clue to his identity she gives us is his uncle was JFK. How would you know who that is?
Could be anyone.
Wow,
could be me.
Mythical figures you're speaking of here.
And, you know, it's not exactly structured around like a plot or an argument. It is a meditative, meandering journey through Nuzzi's memories, through her impressions.
The vacation she took to Hawaii once, the Britney Spears concert she went to once.
Written in like very self-consciously, like faux literary.
Oh my God.
Like really overwritten. It's stylistically very different from what she was doing for a long time at like New York Magazine as a political reporter and commentator there. And it is an attempt at a career pivot. So before we get too much into the book itself, can we, like, I actually do think this is a little bit media inside baseball-y. I think if you are not terminally online or, like, employed as somebody who writes about American politics or works for one of the, you know, two remaining magazines, you might not know who this woman is or why there was so much press around her book. So does anybody want to give us, like, the 10,000-foot summary, executive summary of Olivia Nuzzi?
I feel like you're the only one of us who's ever been like a real journalist. So I feel like you know this better than we do.
This journalist is a very generous interpretation of my career.
I have like no actual like insight into any of this.
Adrian, you do it.
So I was aware of her as a byline and I knew that she was working, I believe, at New York Magazine. And that's pretty much all I knew. You know, she was sort of a name that I would come across. And sometimes I liked what she wrote. Sometimes I didn't like what she wrote. It was a kind of journalism I didn't spend a ton of time on. She was a campaign journalist. And that's often something that, like, you know, I read the first three paragraphs and then, like, my eyes glaze over. I'm like, okay, you followed Chris Christie to a Waffle House in Canton, Ohio. I'm gonna check out, honestly. Like, life is short. But it wasn't bad. The thing that really set her apart was the fact that, like, she clearly sort of had a hand in shaping the narratives around the 2024 election, which then made it pretty spicy to find out that she was sexting RFK the entire time. And then, everyone was clowning on this book. The rituals around this book have been quite interesting. I mean, it's fair to say that it has gone over like a turd in a hot tub, is I think the way I'd put it, since we're sticking with metaphors. Like, if the Thomas Chatterton Williams book was greeted with a collective shrug, that has not been true of this.
Yeah, this was like epicac for the entire U.S. media system.
Yeah.
What's so interesting about it, too, is that it was totally accepted by kind of the literary establishment before it came out, right? She got an excerpt published in Vanity Fair, which is extremely prestigious. She had a job as the West Coast editor, whatever the fuck that means, of Vanity Fair before this came out. The New York Times wrote a like slobbering profile of her before this came out, where the author in the comments was like, she's such a brilliant person and a brilliant writer, just totally glazing her. The minute people, like ordinary people, see the text of the book, they're just like, this is fucking gibberish. Nobody wants this at all. It was like only people who run magazines who seem to think that this woman is a talented writer or has anything interesting to say. And to me, that feels like that's really what the story is about, is that this person like whose journalism I do not think yielded any interesting insights. She had access to people like Chris Christie, Rudy Giuliani. Like, she goes to lunch with these people and she hangs out with them, but she doesn't have any insights about policy.
Yeah.
She's just like, oh, when you shake his hand, Donald Trump's hands are like wet and slimy. Okay, but that doesn't really tell me anything.
So soft, it's almost wet. Yeah.
Almost wet. It's like, this doesn't, like, I guess I'm supposed to be marveling at how much access to these people you have, but also I didn't fucking learn anything about American politics. I don't respect this kind of work. And then she comes out with this book that is like even more vapid than the kind of work she produces when she's being overseen by editors. And the whole country, I mean, you guys saw it only sold something like 1,200 copies the first week. I'm sure that's tapered off even more.
I think basically everybody who read this book reviewed it or talked about it on a podcast.
There's been 1,200 podcast episodes about it. You're like, that's suspicious.
Lines up exactly.
Olivia Nuzzi was, I think she was originally at the Daily Beast very early in her career.
Super. She was like 22.
Yeah. She was very, very young. Mm.
And they like invented a job for her, which New York Magazine did. Like, this happens again and again where high level people at the top of these organizations invent roles for Olivia Nuzzi because they believe she is so talented that we have to carve out a special job for her. And then she produces work that is not interesting.
Or because she's having sex with somebody powerful who gets her a job. I think that might be a little bit more of a shortcut to like explanation of how she got to cover presidential politics at the Daily Beast as her first journalism job, which does seem to be what she did.
I cannot say that. You can say that. As a feminist, you can say that. I'm not going to say that. It sounds too bad.
Well, I mean, I am a person with a little bit of experience thinking about the way that women are treated in the media. And it is not that people with no talent get handed jobs because they're fucking some old guy. It's that there's a million people with talent. And the one who wind up fucking some old guy is often the one who gets, you know, the nice email when they apply for the job. Like, hey, look out for this young lady. Right. I just happen to know.
Although I will say there is no direct evidence.
No, there's no direct evidence of quid pro quo in her career.
It is remarkable how young she had these very high level jobs at magazines. But there is no evidence of any sort of impropriety.
So she had what sounds like a pretty tumultuous childhood in a like standard middle-class home in suburban New Jersey. Mm. And she got plucked out of that tumultuous childhood home by Keith Olbermann.
Oh, are you doing a thing?
Keith Olbermann. No, it's literally the only way I can remember his name. I don't know this guy. He's a million years old. I do not know his work. Other people close to me know this his work.
Oh my God.
He's like a sports commentator.
You're too young. Olbermann started as a sports commentator and then reinvented himself as a kind of anti-Bush truth teller during the Bush administration. Very annoying, very sanctimonious, and then kind of disappeared.
He does the thing that men always do when they're very confident that nothing that they've done is wrong, which is emphasize that she was 18.
Yeah.
He really repeatedly returns to the claim that she was 18 when he moved her out of her, you know, alcoholic tragedy laden childhood home in New Jersey, installed her in an apartment in Manhattan, bought her a bunch of fancy clothes and started paying her tuition to go to college. So she was at a very young age completely financially dependent on a dramatically older man who was expecting sex from her. So that's like not great.
And she was 19. He was 53. I think at the time. Although what's weird about the book is like there's many missed opportunities about this book, but she doesn't like talk about this at all. I would have liked just like some basic biographical details. Her home life really does sound awful. I mean, her mother had schizophrenia and was an alcoholic. Her dad was working like three or four jobs. Her brother is much older than her. So basically it was just her alone in the house with her extremely troubled mom for like most of her childhood. It seems like, like really, really awful way to grow up. And then it seems like she's sort of rescued, or like what she perceived as being rescued at age 19 by this older, wealthy man. She moves to Manhattan. She has said nothing whatsoever about this. She talks around it in the book. In interviews, I've seen people ask her more or less directly about it. And she's just like, I went to college and then I became a journalist. And she doesn't say anything about like this 4-year relationship with this guy who's like way older than her.
Olbermann does not have that kind of reticence. Yeah. He is very willing to talk shit about her in public in this like very scorned man kind of a way.
It's like, oh, she was crazy when I dated her when she was 19. Like, yeah, wow, you look really great in this scenario.
Yeah. It's, I don't know. I don't think the one who looks bad in this story is her.
Yeah.
She very quickly gets a job covering the presidential race, basically as her first job. And she is immediately covering Trump. And her career sort of does really begin at the moment that he comes onto the national stage.
Oh, I didn't know that.
She then spends a big chunk. She moves to New York Magazine and spends a big chunk of her career at New York Magazine, where she's writing, as you guys have alluded to, these kind of like more atmospheric takes on the Trump administration. She is legitimately very well sourced in the Trump One White House.
Yeah.
And she is very good at pumping out these like long form, chatty magazine articles that give you a sense of what the social life and vibe and sort of ethos of the Trump White House is. What she's not really good at doing is being like, they're going to, you know, do this with the Ukrainian aid, right? She's not breaking news.
Yeah, there's no policy. There's no policy in any of her work, ever.
She's not breaking news. She's not analyzing policy. That's not really what she does.
Yeah.
What she does is try to, like, evoke their characters. And she's, like, she's kind of funny.
Mm.
She is, like, snide and knowing. That is her affect, even when she's very young.
And she was also very funny on Twitter. She's clearly very smart.
Yeah. She's very funny on Twitter.
Exactly. None of which makes it onto the pages of this book, we should say.
No. It's a big pivot.
Yeah.
It's a big pivot from the book. If you're familiar with what she was doing at New York Magazine, as I am, the stylistic and the sort of like posture that she takes in the book is very, very different.
Yeah.
At some point, she leaves older man behind and pivots to another older man, Ryan Lizza, around the time he gets fired from The New Yorker, allegedly, because of an inappropriate to like borderline harassing sexual relationship he had there. So he gets fired from The New Yorker for being some kind of sex pest.
Yeah, we have zero details on that. All we have is like some sort of sexual misconduct. He denies it. New Yorker investigated and said it was worth firing. And that's like literally all the information that's in the
and
public.
And that's all they're saying. Yeah. So he did something that The New Yorker considered fireable.
Mm.
And he won't say anything. And she's not saying anything about what it was. Lizza now reports that she like took his side during this, you know, Me Too witch hunt thing.
Yeah, she says that too. I watched an interview with her where she says, I still think it's a false allegation, basically. Yeah.
I don't think it was a false allegation against Ryan Lizza. He also, I believe, was like married with kids at the time, takes off from that relationship and starts playing house with Olivia Nuzzi in DC. Right. So like now another older media man is her like patron and partner. And they stay together for like a decade.
Yeah.
And, you know, she is a little less well-sourced in the Biden administration. She's not really doing so many of the like splashy long form takes. But in 2024, pretty quickly after that disastrous debate of Joe Biden, Olivia Nuzzi comes out with this article where she talks about how old Biden is and suggests that his aides are trying to cover up his infirmity from the public. And that does open the floodgates of people sort of like, there's like a lot of like cover your ass journalism about Biden's age in the summer of 2024, spring of 2024, especially after that debate where he was like so ostentatiously incompetent.
Mm.
And then later that summer, it comes out, you know, that meanwhile, like Nuzzi is continuing to cover the 2024 presidential campaign, not just Biden, but she writes a profile of RFK Jr. for New York Magazine, which is weird because New York Magazine had already published a profile of RFK Jr. They had commissioned Rebecca Traister, a very talented, like more analytical political writer, to do a profile of RFK, which she did. And they published, I think they put it on the cover. But then apparently, like, Nuzzi lobbied for this other profile.
Yeah, yeah.
And according to her, that's when her, like, personal relationship with RFK begins.
Yeah, that was late 2023 when that came out.
And he's running for president at the time, and he drops out. And around the time he's getting ready to drop out, the rumor goes somewhat public. I think it was like a media industry newsletter.
Yeah, yeah.
That Nuzzi has been having this relationship with him and that New York Magazine knows about it and is investigating. I got text messages from people I had not talked about in years.
Oh, yeah.
This was a piece of gossip that really like lit up the media world with like Schadenfreude.
It is a huge story. Like a prominent national level political journalist is having a sexual relationship with one of the candidates as they're negotiating a role in the Trump administration. Like, it's a genuine, like, I know this kind of gets covered as a gossip thing, and I think the tabloids covered it as, like, a sex thing, but it's, like, a huge journalistic ethics story. It's, like, one of the biggest ones since Stephen Glass. It's, like, a huge deal that this happened.
And it's also coming at a moment where, like, first of all, I think there wouldn't have been quite as much emotional investment in Nosy's downfall if people didn't really kind of suspect that she was a little bit conservative leading anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
The fact that she was very, very well sourced in the first Trump administration and much less sourced in the Biden administration implied, I think, to a lot of people that she was more at ease with Republicans.
Right. And she wrote a very glowing profile of Trump in November of 2024, right before the election. I mean, she wrote this like humanizing profile. And when she posted it, she was like, people say we shouldn't be humanizing him, but I think it's important to humanize him. So she openly was saying, like, I'm going to try to make Trump a three-dimensional person a month before the fucking election where he wins and her essentially boyfriend gets installed in his administration. Like, to me, the whole kind of ethics angle has all been about, like, was she trying to help RFK's campaign, which I think he was always going to drop out, but like she was helping Trump's campaign at a time when he was negotiating for a role in the administration. Her boyfriend would have been unemployed if Trump didn't win, and he would have been employed if Trump won. And so just the extremely basic incentives of her as a campaign journalist at that time were really clear, and she totally admits to this in the book. She's like helping him negotiate his role in the Trump administration while she's writing this piece humanizing Trump.
I think that's fair. And I also think that part of what is so sticky about the Nosy story is that we're in a moment where there's like a big distrust of media and a big distrust of elites. Mm. Like this is, in fact, like the trend in American life that brought Donald Trump to power and is now sort of like turning on him. And the sort of corruption of elites, their indifference to morality, their incestuous relationships. Like this is also what animates a lot of outrage at the Epstein stuff. Yeah. I think even more than the like actual trafficking of children in that story is like people are really mad at how corrupt the rich are and how corrupt the powerful are and how they're all fucking friends with each other in ways that create these conflicts of interest.
Yeah. And they circle the wagons to defend each other. Like people are circling the wagons to defend Nuzzi. Like, oh, haven't we all slept with our sources? Like, no.
Yeah, no, we haven't. No. It really crystallizes in metaphor something that people sort of understand in spirit, just like, oh my God, they're all in bed together, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's no commitment to principle among these people. There's like a commitment to self-interest and to protecting their friends and to like maintaining their status within this club.
And also it is a very sexist trope, like the journalist who sleeps with her sources. Like it happens to be true in this case, but also the fact that it was like a ready narrative for people to draw on was also kind of helped because it's just like it's an archetype that you know, even if in general that archetype is false, it just happens to be true in this case.
Yeah, no, she made other female journalists look really, really
bad. Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah.
And now like gender critiques of this story have focused on defending Nosy from sexism in the critiques of her, right? And like there's this kind of simplistic reductive thing. It's like, well, either sexism is a real presence in this discourse and therefore she didn't do anything wrong, or she did something wrong, and therefore none of the criticisms of her contain sexism. I think that's kind of a false dichotomy. I think sexism can inflect the discourses or the thinking or the language of people who have like legitimate grievances. And I don't think you have to be a good person to be victimized by sexism. I think like sexism is wielded at bad people, bad women, like all the time. But like there's kind of one, it's like, oh, don't go after the woman for this sexual transgression that is sexist. I think that's kind of dumb. That's like what Lisa Taddeo did in like Airmail. She's like, haven't we all been overcome by Eros? It's like, well, not like this, not with the anti-vax guy.
Well, yeah, we've all loved too hard.
Like, oh, she fell in love. Like, what are you fucking 12
no,
years old?
Exactly.
Like, no, she didn't. First of all, no, she fucking didn't.
Also, I think the way the tabloids covered it too, if you read the old like New York Post coverage, especially like right after the scandal broke, a lot of it was just people being scandalized by the fact that a grown woman was sexting. It's like she was sending nudes. And like, that's extremely common behavior these days. Just descriptively, it's common. I think sexting is fun and wholesome. I don't really give a shit that she was sexting. I care about who she was sexting, what she was getting in exchange. Like, there was all this, also this weird parsing of like, did they have sex? Did they not have sex? I don't care. I think they were clearly carrying on an emotional and sexual relationship, whatever form that took. And so the fact that she was having a sexual relationship with one of the candidates while covering the campaign is just kind of like, I don't necessarily need to know the details about that. But like, the scandalous part is not that like a grown woman was sexting. I really don't give a shit about that. It's like,
sexting is not wrong.
Yeah, it's fine.
Like, I don't care about sexting in isolation. I think sexting RFK Jr. is always wrong.
Yeah, he's a huge piece of shit. There's also that aspect. Like,
nobody is sexting RFK Jr. who either respects themselves or deserves mine.
Yeah.
You know? And I think also like sexting your sources as a journalist who's supposed to be holding these people to account is wrong.
Yeah.
But like, this brings me back to the other gendered aspect of this, which is that, like, it's scab behavior, right? Mm. To, like, trade sex for professional advancement the way that, like, Nosy seems to have been doing, at least in this episode, puts other women in your field in a position where that is presumed acceptable.
Right.
Like, an acceptable thing to demand of them or something that other people are going to suspect them of doing. Mm. It's like, it's scab shit, right? You have a degree of responsibility to other women to not trade on your own sex and gender in ways that enable the further degradation of other women based on sex and gender lines, right? And like, I think she failed that responsibility to us.
It makes sexters look bad. It's making all of us out here, you know? Just standing up for people who sexed appropriately with appropriate people. Don't throw me under the bus.
Yes, the female and horny communities are both victimized here. Yeah.
But with RFK Jr., you also never know, are you sexting him or are you sexting the brain worm, man?
Yeah.
You look so slithery. What? All right, so unfortunately, that is the end of our free preview. If you liked what you heard, please go over to patreon.com/inbedwiththeright and subscribe. Make sure to leave a comment. Make sure to recommend the show to others. And stay tuned for non-paywalled content next week. Thank you so much for your support and for listening.